We're all set. We will start this morning with business coordinations under common control. Like Julia.
Thank you, Hans. I'll pardon the world.
Okay.
Thank you. So we are looking at agenda paper 23, business combination under common control, and the objective of the paper and of today's discussion is to ask you whether you agree to clarify the scope of the project. So as we mentioned in our education session last month, the board already made a decision on scope in 2014, and at that time the board decided that the project should consider business combination under common control currently excluded from the scope of IFRS 3, group restructuring, and the need to clarify the description of a business combination under common control. The board also decided to give priority to considering transactions that involve third parties, but it is important to note that the board did not restrict the scope of the project to such transaction only. So the project will consider business combination and group restructuring regardless of whether those transactions affect third parties or are take place in connection with an IPO. Now, when we prepare this paper, we look at the two main components of the board decision. So on one side, business combination under common control. On the other side, group restructuring. And starting with business combination under common control, what we note is that these transactions are excluded from the scope of the IFRS 3, so are included in the scope of this project, and these transactions are described in IFRS 3. So we have an IFRS standard a description to which refer in order to identify those transactions. However, we are aware that there are some application questions as to whether specific transactions satisfy the description of business combination under common control, and in particular, there are some questions related to the meaning of transitory control in the description of business combination under common control. So in a future agenda paper, we will provide you with an overview of all the question and submission that the interpretation committee received, and also we will ask you how to best clarify the meaning of transitory control. If we now move to the second element of the scope decision, so group restructuring, what we note is that group restructuring is not a defined term. Its meaning is not discussed in any IFRS standard, and different parties understood it differently in a broader or narrower way. So we thought that the board should clarify which transaction other than business combination under common control are included in the scope of the project. And to properly identify and describe this population, we consider the broad group of transactions that involve restructuring relationship between entities or businesses under common control. And what we note is that these transactions would involve the transfer of entities or businesses within a group. Then we look at those transfer, analyzing its consequences from the point of view of the parties involved in the transaction, so controlling party, transferring party, transfer party, and receiving party. And what we note is that the accounting for such transactions from the perspective of the receiving party is not covered by any IFRS standard. And this is true regardless of whether the receiving party or any of the combining entity can be identified as an acquirer if we were to apply the requirement in IFRS 3. So accordingly, we recommend that the board should clarify that the scope of the business combination project and the common control project include transaction between entities under common control in which the reporting entity obtained control of one of more businesses, regardless of whether, if applied, IFRS 3 would identify that reporting entity as the accounting acquirer. And this is the wording of our recommendation, and it is also the wording of our question for you, which is on page 10. And before leaving the floor to the discussion, just a couple of points to note. In the appendix of the paper, we provided some example of transaction that will be in the scope of the project according to our recommendation. And just last point to note, consistently with how the scope is defined in IFRS 3, our recommendation does not specify to which financial statement any requirements, any accounting requirements developed in this project will apply, so consolidated versus separate or individual.
Just a comment then. I really like the paper. I like, in particular, I think the way you use the graphs really help us identify what we are aiming here. In paragraph 25 is your basic recommendation. Just to really be clear, when we are the type of transactions that we intend to include in the scope of the project are only the transactions that, as you say, the reporting entity obtains control. So if they don't obtain control, it will be out of the.
Yeah. Yes, essentially we are looking at situations where you have, as a result of this restructuring, you have a new reporting entity, which includes now a different combination of businesses compared to what existed before the transaction.
Gary.
Good morning. Anne Marie, as you know, I support the staff's recommendation. I think stepping back from it, I think the objective of this work is going to be a DP. To start getting narrow and exclusionary defeats the purpose of trying to address the subject. I mean, I've been involved in this sort of work for many decades. I mean, these things should be, you start getting highly defined and specific. You just invite structuring and workarounds. Every possible structure that can't exist will exist. So I think we have to take a broad view, which is basically, in your case, you obtain control, but you're not subject to IFRS 3. And I think that's the right way to do it at this point in time. And we can narrow scope and get more specific if it's a change of shares or change of stock or if you have a non-corporate entity in between later on. I think for right now you got the exact proper recommendation.
Yes, thank you. Yes, with respect to reporting entity discussion, I agree with staff's recommendation. Just let me understand further a little bit with using the graph, the diagram on page 11. On page 11, excuse me. You say that the reporting entity is A, because A controls B. That's why it's within the scope. And based on the presumption that the entity A is the reporting entity, we explore our standard for BCUCC. Then at the same time, P is also controlling A and B. P is also reporting entity, if P is listed. So in that case, we may have two reporting entity. And is there any possibility that these two reporting entities may have different accounting treatment? Okay. Is that the way you are going to move forward?
Yes, of course, but in this case, okay, they are both reporting entity, but yeah. If we look at our staff recommendation, the transaction we are looking at are a transaction where a reporting entity obtained control. And yeah. If we look at the P yeah. level, so P perspective, P doesn't obtain control of a new entity, because before the transaction, P control A and B, and after the transaction, P still control A and B.
Same.
So it's not a trend. At P level, this transaction is not a transaction within the scope of this project, because nothing happened for its perspective.
I see. So in this case, so for example, the typical example is on the page.
Yeah, it's similar to figure two or figure one in the paper.
Page seven,
He is the controlling entity in this case, and well, depending of if there are non-controlling interests or not, there might be some transaction to account for. That if there are no non-controlling interests, basically what happened in example one is nothing for the P perspective, because before the transaction it controlled A and B, and after the transaction still control A and B.
Okay, so let me understand with using figure two. So in this figure 2. So it's same as figure 1, basically. And then in this case, so receiving party will be a controlling?
In figure 2, receiving party will be the reporting entity.
And how about P?
P is also reporting entity. But the transaction at P level, so for the P perspective, does not satisfy the description in our recommendation. So the transaction for at that level is not part of our...
Okay, then
if I could just clarify. Yeah. So I think it is important that for each reporting entity that can be involved in this transaction, there are IFRS requirements. Yeah. When we looked at various reporting entities that can be involved in this transaction, for other reporting entities, we already have requirements in IFRS. The only gap in literature that we have in this instance is for entity A. So if entity A is a reporting entity, we don't have requirements, we need to look at those. From P perspective, we already have the requirements, so there is no need for us to do anything else. Mm. And also in this scenario and in many other scenarios, you can have more than one controlling party, right? So in this scenario, A is the immediate controlling party, but it can have 10 or 20 other controlling parties on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's for A where we lack guidance, and it is A that we are focusing on in this project.
Focuses on A rather than on P?
Yes.
Okay.
Darryl?
I just wanted to clarify a couple of points that came out of that conversation. I think the first thing is this whole approach is irrelevant if A is not a reporting entity.
Yeah.
It doesn't need accounting. So it's only if it happens to be a reporting entity. Second thing is as things stand at the moment, there is no requirement in anything we've discussed up to now that P, in fact, be a reporting entity. So P might, for the moment, be an individual, say.
Yes.
So that is also completely excluded from the way we think about it.
Mm.
But then the one other question I thought I heard you ask, and I just want to... It is possible under the structure, if you were to apply acquisition accounting at the level of A, that you get a different outcome for A to what P has.
What
so you actually have numbers that are different between A and P. If we assume, this is a scoping exercise, but if we assume that the measurement or the approach exercise we get to is acquisition accounting.
Mary?
I think that overall, I support the staff recommendations about scope. I think my comments and points are more about clarifying how we express those conclusions rather than disagreement. The point that we were just discussing, and this kind of goes back to something that, to Amaro's question, I think once we focus in and identify the scope and address those transactions, there are a number of other transactions about which questions have been raised that the staff is saying, you know, Yulia, you were just saying that you think there are applicable IFRSs to address those transactions. And I think there maybe has been some diversity in practice over the years in terms of whether people have applied the BC under common control exemption for other transactions, partly because of the wording of that transaction, partly because of the wording of other standards. So I think it might be helpful to communicate that we plan to basically plug the gap but also to clarify what other standards apply to those other transactions, because I don't want to send a signal that we're going to plug this gap but leave uncertainty, you know, or the argument that some things are still floating in space without any applicable standard, because what I'm hearing from the staff is you think this plugs the last gap in this area of common, you know, transactions between entities under common control. And so I think I would just bring out the point that through the scope and through the guidance, we also expect that we will resolve any uncertainty about the other transactions.
Just maybe to clarify, if this is, Mary, what your concern relates to. So as Anna noted, we are aware that there are questions about whether a particular transaction is a business combination under common control, and therefore today there is sort of a choice of what you do under IS-8, or whether a particular transaction is a business combination and therefore you would apply the acquisition accounting. So we are aware of these questions. We haven't answered them in this paper, but we have indicated that it's coming to a future meeting with a recommendation for the board.
And what I'm just getting to is, if you're looking at figure 2, where you have all the X's, as in X meaning we don't need to answer this because we believe the literature is clear, I think there may be some people who have different views about, you know, one of the transactions at an X level, you know, what the clearly required literature is. So I think it's just making clear that the work that we are doing, and I appreciate we haven't reached conclusions, we're just about what the accounting will be, that if we think we're filling all the voids, you know, the void that exists because of the scope exception, we might also have to clarify what we think, you know, what we believe are the applicable requirements of other standards for these other transactions that in figure 2 have an X through them.
Okay.
I'm not sure that everyone that has an X through them, but it, if I think about something we had a discussion about at the last interpretation committee meeting.
I wouldn't put those in that. I wondered if you were speaking in code alluding to that. But I wouldn't have put that in the same category as these things with crosses through them.
No, I agree. It's another bucket of transactions for which people have some different readings of the applicability of the BC under common control exemption that's in IFRS 3. So I think we might just have to inventory, and this is, I think, what Anna Maria described in terms of the paper that you'll bring subsequently, to identify the transactions about which questions have been asked.
Yes.
And so I think that it's just a matter of communicating that in resolving this, we think if there's any questions remaining, that people think there's transactions that still fall under a common control exemption, that we believe that the work that we do will resolve what we think are the applicable existing IFRSs, because basically you're telling us that you're going to take away that exemption, which is, you know, which is the source, I think, of some diversity on peripheral transactions. So that was one thing. Second, I the expression of the scope in both paragraph 2 and then the question, I get what you mean, but it's maybe not it sounds like we think there are a group of business combinations for which IFRS 3 tells you to identify as the acquirer an entity that doesn't obtain control. And I think what instead you're referring to with the phrasing of the question and the phrasing of paragraph 2 is that IFRS 3 also provides guidance for when you should do reverse acquisition accounting when the legal acquirer is not the accounting acquirer. And I think you're saying that in this project, we'll basically mimic the scope of IFRS 3.
It will be a little bit broader than IFRS 3. And what I mean is that if you have a reverse acquisition, it's still an acquisition, it's still a business combination. You still have one entity that is identified as acquiree and another entity identified as the acquirer. It's just accounting sort of sides of the transaction.
Yeah.
Are not the same as the legal size of the transaction. But in the context of a group restructuring, you can have a transaction which is not even a business combination.
That was the new code that just is basically shared.
Yes. So that's example 3 in our appendix.
Right.
So that is not sort of possible between unrelated parties. So we are trying to be clear that type of the transaction where you don't even have a business combination, you just have a continuation of your existing business in a new legal shell. So that transaction is included in the scope.
So it's not just that it's paralleling the scope of IFRS 3.
It's broader.
It's that plus this transaction that we believe is unique to this. And then last on the point that Daryl and Tuck were talking about, I don't know, but I would not be surprised if there may be some practice that says if you have a transaction involving entities under common control and you have a change in basis as a result of that, that somehow that change in basis flows up to consolidated P. And I'm taking from your comment, you know, from the comments you made, and I agree with them, that we think, in effect, the consolidation requirements trump. In other words, from P Group's consolidated perspective, there's been no change in the entities included within P Group, so there would be no accounting effect from that reorganization. Let's assume there is no NCI.
Yeah.
And that, again, just may be something that we need to confirm, because some may view the change, you know, if you think about consolidation as a roll-up exercise, people may carry forward that change in basis up to P. I think it's a struggle to think about how you square that with the requirements of IFRS 10, but I wouldn't be surprised if that practice is out there.
We have attempted to already sort of make this observation in this paper in paragraph 22, but if we need to beef it up in the future paper, we can certainly do it, and we can maybe take it.
I think we need huge amounts of deliberation around it, but I think we might underestimate the extent to which that scope exception has been applied broadly and created diversity in practice, and it might just be worth us spending some time in the discussion, you know, if it's the discussion paper, spelling out some of the consequences.
I just wanted to make one observation to an earlier Mary's comment to make sure that we're on the same page. So when we were talking about filling the void and looking at peripheral transactions, so I just want to be clear that we are looking at the void that is created by IFRS 3. So as Sue mentioned, if there are questions around other standards, such as IS 28, for example, we will certainly keep it in mind, and we will think about those interactions as we work on this project, but they're not directly in the scope of this project, if it makes sense.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree with your recommendation. I'm happy to see expanding the scope. However, I'm just concerning with some kind of unintended consequences of this expanding the scope. And another point is how can we suggest a kind of a principle-based explanation on this kind of expansion of the scope? We just said that even though there is no acquirer that satisfies the definition of the IFR 3, you know, that's a very specific kind of a fact for the another transaction we are going to deal with. But if we can provide some kind of more conceptual basis why we include this transaction in this project. For example, this is still a kind of business combination, right? But that not IFRS 3 type of business combination. So we can describe this special transaction as a more principle-based one rather than just a rule-based description of the scope. That will make us much, be safe in dealing with other transactions. Maybe some of our stakeholders might suggest to think, for us to think about the other transactions. Another thing is, in the example of 3, the P creates a new company that acquires a subsidiary A. In this case, do you have another regarding the requirements on the how this P creates a new company? It's a kind of a split, spin-off, or carve-out.
In our example, what we thought is like a creation of a really new form entity, so an empty shell, and this empty shell is that then used to acquire A. So once again, even in example 3, nothing changed at P level because it's still control A through an empty shell, but it still control the same exact businesses as control before.
So
and if I could maybe emphasize another point here, so it doesn't matter how legally, like how exactly it was structured, And that's why, for example, we choose to use the words obtain control rather than acquire in the staff recommendation. So it doesn't matter how it's done, but if as a result of whatever the parent has done, we now have a NUCA around business A, this is in the scope. And also, Chinggu, to your earlier point, we haven't really added anything to the scope. All we're looking to do is to clarify what we mean by group restructuring. All we're looking to do is to clarify what the board already decided and to be very specific about what we're looking at.
Yeah, I understand, but basically our stakeholders suggested many transactions to for us to, you know, develop a standard, because there is a diversity in accounting on such transactions. So as I said before, there are some spin-offs, carve-outs, whether this is an equity transaction or profit and loss transaction. And why they are asking us why we just focus on business combination, the common control. There are many others. Still, we don't provide any accounting standards. So that's what I'm saying, you know, we need to restrict, limit our scope clearly, you know, not to give some kind of positive implication to those stakeholders. They might dream, they think their transaction might be included in this project in future, but we are not going to deal with such issues or such transactions. We are focusing on business combination.
But not just business combinations, also the transaction on page 13, example 3, where you don't have a combination, but you have a new reporting entity around an old business that's also in the scope.
Okay, Nick.
Thank you. I was just looking for some clarification around prioritisation. So in your introductory remarks, you referred to the decision, I think, that we made at the last board meeting to prioritise those transactions that involved third parties. Now, I accept that doesn't rule out any other transactions, hence the debate today. But what does that prioritisation mean in practice, and how can we retain that relative focus on those transactions that involve third parties?
I think it's fair to say that as we look, sort of think about the kind accounting requirements for those transactions, one of the key driver in our thinking will be the information needs of users of financial statements. And if, for example, a transaction is undertaken in preparation for an IPO, or if there is NCI in the receiving entity, there are third users, there are information needs of those parties. As opposed to it, if you have a restructuring within the group and there are no external equity or debt investors in the receiving entity, then the question becomes, well, who are users of those financial statements other than the parent himself, who already has all the information they need? So I think we will be focusing on the need of users as one of the key sort of cornerstones in our thinking.
I agree with the staff recommendations. So if I understood you correctly, when you mentioned IAS 28, what you were saying was would do the work that's planned within the scope of this project and then think about what the consequence is for IAS 28, and then we'll be in a position to decide whether that's enough or what the consequence is and whether anything additional needs to be done. So it's not in the scope per se,
yeah,
but it's something we'll think about because it's an open question. Yeah. The other thing I think that Mary was saying, which is a good point, and I think it's also apparent in the discussion that we're having, is that we've got very specific and very particular thinking about how consolidation works and also what the terminology in IFRS 3 means. And the example that made me notice it in particular was your very particular focus on the use of the word acquisition versus obtaining control. And I know exactly why you're making that distinction, and I hear what you're saying and that means something to me, but I think it's quite subtle for a lot of people probably out in the IFRS world. And similarly, I think some of the things where we've got crosses and we say, well, we all know how to do that. We all know how to do that, but I'm not sure we can be confident everybody outside the building knows how to do that. So I don't think those are necessary. Well, firstly, when we're doing this project, I think it's a great opportunity to take every chance we can for education. So being very careful about why we use the word acquisition or not, because I think it also has a knock-on benefit in terms of understanding of the terminology in IFRS 3. But secondly, even though I don't think, you know, it's really your concern to be telling people how to do the accounting for the stuff that's crossed out, because you're correct, we already have literature that covers it, maybe we should at least be taking a note of where maybe there's uncertainties or differences of opinion, and thinking about whether we've got opportunities either to produce extra material to help people understand that that's how the accounting already works, not for you, but for the organisation, where the accounting, if we've got opportunity to come up with, I don't know, educational materials or other materials, or whether there's particular things where maybe there might be some lack of understanding or differences of opinion, where we could take the opportunity to help people, to step people through how the requirements work and the crossed out things, because I think it will help us address some of the concerns that keep being raised about how complex our requirements might be. So if we've got an opportunity to come up with some new materials that help people understand that these are what the words in the book already mean, but now we see that maybe not everybody understands what that meant, so can we come up with something that helps people? And maybe there's a role for our educational department, or whether there's some stuff that might even come to the interpretations committee, where we could use things like the educational agenda decisions that have, you know, due process around them, that we could just keep a note of during your project, not for you to work on per se, but for us collectively in the organisation to think about.
Anne?
Thanks, Hans. Could I just clarify something in paragraph 26, where you say that we're focusing on the transactions and we don't specify the financial statements? Well, we actually couldn't, could we? We couldn't ever specify which financial statements, because we have to be principle-based. But because of this is going to go and apply in so many different scenarios, we don't know. Is that right?
Yes. We just wanted to make this point in the paper, because some people keep asking questions, which financial statements you're looking for. So we needed to clarify.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Just let me help me to understand a little more further in connection with Mary's question. So again, can I have a look at page 8, the figure 2 diagram? This is very good. Actually, in this diagram, A is the under the scope. So this is the area we are targeting. And then We are now discussing scoping, so I don't want to peek ahead too much, but what if we decide that A, in entity A level, we should require acquisition method? What if? So because we have a 30% NCI, and in order to protect the NCI, maybe acquisition method would be better. But this is just within the reporting unit entity of A. P might have a different accounting, because from the level of P, nothing happened. Mm-hmm. So they can keep the predecessor method. Mm-hmm. So then eventually that means, with respect to Mary's question, in the consolidation procedure, we have two methods in practice. One is step-by-step consolidation. The other is direct method. So if we go down the path of direct method, then P has a predecessor method, so carrying value would not change. But when it comes to A has a different carrying amount. And then if we go down the path of step-by-step consolidation, then it doesn't meet the requirement. So I'm wondering, if we go down the path like this, eventually we prohibit doing the step-by-step consolidation method.
I don't think that whatever approach we come up with in this project will affect how accounting is made. So the key idea is that at P level, any effects of intergroup transactions need to be eliminated. And, you know, how specifically entities get to this point in their systems, it's a different question.
Okay, so it has nothing to do with the method of consolidation. Okay. Even in the step-by-step method, you have to eliminate the special effect at the level of P-level consolidation. Okay, thank you.
This is coming up so often as a question just around this table, though, that I think that even though, while I agree with you, Yulia, that we're not envisaging that P would be affected in this fact pattern, in any document we put out for comment, I think we're going to have to make that observation so people A, realise it, and B, can comment on it, because I'm not sure that it's going to be, if we keep asking the question, it's not as intuitive as...
And again, we already attempted to sort of discuss it briefly in this paper, but we can always include more analysis in the process document.
And just quickly on this, I think there's a distinction between commenting in this project about what literature we think applies and how you get to the conclusion that X standard or Y standard applies. That's one thing that I think we may want to do. There's a whole other category that is, please explain how you apply the literature that you've just identified. And I think that's outside the scope of that. That's more the education material. But I think where there's the debate sometimes is the chain of logic that gets you to saying this piece of existing literature applies.
All right. Well, I gather from the discussion that we can support the staff's recommendation.
14-0.
Right.
Thank you.
And we continue with the conceptual framework.
John.
Yeah, I'm going to this morning be discussing matters arising from the review of the pre-ballot draft of the new conceptual framework. There's a couple of matters to discuss, and the first one is in paper 10A, and it's to do with the liability definition. And it's specifically concerns about the paragraphs of the pre-ballot draft that discuss the need for a past event, which is a past action of the entity that will or may require it to transfer a resource that it wouldn't otherwise have had to transfer. And the concerns that were raised were that, as it's drafted in the pre-ballot draft, it seems to be suggesting that a past event isn't always required, and that could lead to a conclusion that liability should be recognised for all sorts of future costs. Now, that wasn't the intention. And so we think that we can sort the problem by drafting improvements. And so you don't need to revisit your earlier decisions or make any new decisions. But because it was one of the most significant concerns raised by the reviewers of the pre-ballot draft, and because some of our suggestions for drafting amendments would involve significant redrafting, we thought we should ask you to approve our approach. And the first question is on page 9 of the paper. So the staff recommend that we address the concerns by improving the drafting so that there's no need for the board to revisit its previous decisions. Do you agree?
Excellent. First, I think it's very wise for us to consider the feedback in this stage of the project, because we still have time. And if it causes confusion, it's good to be clear. On the paragraph 15, in the drafting, I have only one suggestion for you to consider. I hesitate a little bit in going to the negative form instead of the positive that we had before. I'm not a specialist in English, but I always prefer the positive form instead of does not yet have or has not yet received. I always find more complicated than going straight to the point that we prefer. But of course, staff have gave loads of consideration on how to best write this, and I accept that.
Could I just reply to that particular point? The first, we do have a paragraph that states it in the positive first, yeah. And we're sort of just reinforcing it with a paragraph that states
in
it
negative.
In the negative
yeah.
as well. So it's not instead of.
And, but my suggestion is actually, I really like the paragraph at the end of the day. But my suggestion is that the very last sentence, I think it's confusing after the executory contract. So actually, it's the example clarifies very clearly the one issue that was brought to us. And the up to the point that I affirm or clarify this executory contract, when I enter the last sentence, I think it makes it confusing, can be confusing again. So I don't think, personally, this is really essential for us to achieve the meaning, the last sentence. So just to consider the possibility of excluding.
Okay. So it's the before then sentence.
Yeah, the before then, the contract is executory, and I would stop there, basically.
Okay.
That's my suggestion.
Okay.
Mary?
Joan, I agree with your analysis that the comments we got do not suggest a fundamental logical inconsistency. That means we have to re-deliberate our conclusions and our package of conclusions. In terms of, and I know I'm jumping ahead to the second question, I think probably I'll avoid specific drafting comments at the table, but it strikes me that we seem to get into trouble when we keep expanding to clarify, you know, to write more to explain what we meant. And so, I know, as you just reminded Amara, that we have a positive expression of what we mean, and we got a lot of comments around the paragraphs that supplement the positive paragraph. So, we have a positive paragraph, then we said it means this. It doesn't mean this, it doesn't mean this, it doesn't mean this. And we got lots of comments around the it doesn't mean this or this is how you read it. I think we should step back and look at whether we're just trying to say too much in the framework itself about what it doesn't mean as opposed to what it does. And I'm not saying let's take out all of these paragraphs, but I think we have to challenge not just a sentence or a piece of a sentence that looks confusing, but whether we're just trying to say too much about it, especially in the conceptual framework itself, as opposed to, for example, in the basis for conclusion, when we might be giving some consideration to the types of issues raised in the comments about why we did not, why we did or didn't see it as, did see it as helpful, didn't see it as contradictory, et cetera. I feel like we're trying to shove too much into the conceptual framework itself. And another thing is, I think we should only go for specific examples in the conceptual framework itself if we're really convinced that it's absolutely necessary to understand the concept, as opposed to it's a nice and useful thing that helps people read along, remembering that the conceptual framework is supposed to survive for a pretty long time without it being a source of alternative analysis of specific transactions. So, I look at this and say, let's steer away from examples if all possible, and let's think about how much we have to expand in the conceptual framework itself about what certain things do not mean as opposed to what they do mean.
I think it's one of those rare occasions when I'm not sure that I agree with Mary. So, I actually really like the changes that you've made to the drafting, and I think I was one of the people that had concerns with the pre-ballot draft on some of the topics that you've addressed, so thank you for proposing to address them. I think this really helps me in terms of understanding how much further the liability definition goes, but that it doesn't go, even further than what might have been intended. And where I don't think I do agree with Mary on this occasion is I certainly agree that it's hard looking at paragraphs in isolation, so you've got to look at the whole thing, so I certainly agree with that. But I think maybe more is more in this case, because there's been so many questions and so much confusion in groups I've been in at World Standard Setters and other sort of forums about just how far does this definition go. And I actually think that while I agree that, you know, in a conceptual framework you want to keep it conceptual, in some of these instances people are finding it so difficult to understand what exactly it is that we do and don't mean, some of these examples, just by making them a bit more concrete, I think it really can help aid understanding. So I actually like the fact that we've got the example of the salaries in this case. So I support the change in the draft.
I agree with everything Mary says, that you should avoid them unless they're absolutely necessary. I just feel this is a place where it's absolutely necessary because we seem to be broadening the definition of a liability, and we have to say this is where it stops. And that's what this paragraph is saying. You know, we seem to be defining it quite broadly, but here's the boundary.
Yeah, and that's where I think people are confused.
And it's quite an abstract boundary as well. And we have, I think, I do agree about examples. I hate examples in the conceptual framework. But this one just seems to give a very simple illustration of a quite abstract concept.
Duck. Thank you. Actually, I agree with the staff's recommendation, but just one point I was not 100% convinced was about removing the simply being in existence. I think I understand why you would like to remove it, because it could confuse some of the readers. However, in theory, there might be the tax, like a poll tax, even if you are dormant, and even if you are not really having an activity, then you still be charged, levy or tax. And as long as you are listed or you are in public and you are obliged to IFRS, so existence itself may cause some liability. So in this sense, having this wording doesn't really harm, because the former part of this sentence, it already said it could include. So it's already said it could include. So therefore, even if it's simply being in existence is a rare case, but this exactly shows how our new concept of liability works. So I don't think we really need to delete it.
Sue does not agree.
No, this was the best thing I could see in this paper was the removal of that, because for me, I think that for those who thought that this was now the never-ending liability definition, I think that was just adding confusion. And so I absolutely agreed with the observation, I think that's in the paper here somewhere, that while you could think of some circumstances where it might be relevant, for the benefit that creates versus the sort of unintended consequences, the cost-benefit trade-off wasn't so good.
Scope is so narrow.
I agree with what you said. I think it's all absolutely true. What I thought about is that it's got this potential to do damage, but also in the situations that you're thinking of, where perhaps a government just comes along and slaps a tax on everybody, or all entities just for existing, there's probably never going to be any doubt as to when that liability arises. It's there, and people won't have difficulty interpreting the concepts for these cases. It's the cases where it is difficult that people will go to the conceptual framework, or the board will go to the conceptual framework, and it's in these cases that simply being existing could be misinterpreted.
I think there's overall a very simple point that we're trying to get to in not only the paragraphs in this paper, but also the surrounding paragraphs in the section of the conceptual framework, and it's that in many instances, let's call it a contract as opposed to regulation, you enter into a contract. You then have, the contract includes a hurdle that if you don't hit the hurdle, you get nothing. But in between when you enter into the contract and you hit the hurdle, you have partial performance. And I think what we're trying to say is entering into the contract is not the past event that, that creates the whole obligation. It's normally entering into the contract is executory. It's you don't avoid having a regulation until you get a liability, until you get to the hurdle, because you have received benefits along the way. So we're just trying to say the past event normally is not entering into the contract. and the obligation is created before you get to the hurdle, because it's the partial delivery along the way. And we just seem to be taking an awful lot of paragraphs to say that.
I think possibly because it is quite complicated. That yeah. There is a past event when you enter into a contract. You have done something.
But it's executory
but
contract.
But it's executory, yeah. And it's just an obligation to exchange, which isn't necessarily a liability. And it's the doing something else. It does seem to need a reasonable amount of explanation.
And so I think in looking at the drafting, because I think the question you brought back to the board is, do all these comments cause you to rethink your decision? And the answer is no. We've identified a couple of things like that. Merely being in existence is being more problematic than beneficial. But maybe even go back and look at whether you're trying to move the executory, the point about it being executory, to the beginning rather than to the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, just really standing back and saying, what is it that we're trying to say?
Okay.
I think we have answered both questions.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Next paper, Julia.
Yes, thank you.
Flowchart.
Flowchart, yes. Moving to agenda today, but then B.
So flowchart.
Right, so a very brief introduction. So as you know, the existing conceptual framework states that to make decisions about resource allocations, users need information about both resources and claims and how efficiently and effectively management has discharged its responsibilities. The existing framework does not use the term stewardship, but the basis for conclusions explains the idea that the need for information to assess stewardship is necessary and it's inherent in the existing framework. So in the light of the feedback the board received in the course of this project, the board decided to reintroduce the term stewardship in the revised conceptual framework. Accordingly, the pre-ballot draft stated that in order to make decisions about resource allocation, users need to be able to assess both prospects for cash flows and be able to assess management stewardship of the entity resources. To make those assessments, users need information about both resources and claims and how effectively and efficiently management has discharged its responsibilities. However, some reviewers of the pre-ballot draft found the description in the pre-ballot draft confusing, and in particular, they found it quite difficult to follow the link between making decisions about resource allocations, expectations about returns, assessment of stewardship and assessment of prospects for cash flows, and then the information needs. So they found this whole chain of logic quite difficult to follow, to the extent that some reviewers felt that we've changed the objective of general purpose financial reporting, which was not, of course, the board's intention. We think that this is because the language in Chapter 1 is already arguably a little bit dense, and the reintroduction of the discussion of stewardship made it even a little bit more dense, and we think it would be helpful to clarify those links. So, of course, those links could be clarified by making further changes to Chapter 1. However, we do not recommend that approach. It's a recent chapter, it's been through due process, and the board didn't want to touch it in the first place. Therefore, we do not recommend further changes to the text of Chapter 1. We think a better approach could be including a simple flow chart in Chapter 1, which would illustrate the links between objective of general purpose financial reporting, returns, assessment of stewardship, and assessment of prospect of cash flows and the information needs. And this is an approach that we recommend. Our staff recommendation is set out in paragraph 2, and illustrative flow chart is included in appendix of agenda paper 10B. Do you agree with our recommendation?
Okay. We're getting excited here. Anne.
I like the flow chart, and I appreciate we're trying to change the text of chapter 1 as little as possible. I just wonder whether the response might be to the flowchart that we've now elevated stewardship to be equal with the decision usefulness rather than part of it. Because in the text of your paper, you talk about stewardship as being part of the information, the usefulness of the information and the way the information might be used, that it's a part of it, and that was always the idea in the original conceptual framework. So I just wonder whether this, because this now has got the blocks and it's on the page, does that then say there are these two uses for the information, and they are have the same prominence?
But I think what's important here is that I think this is exactly what we mean. We mean that there is one single objective, which is to provide information to make resource allocation decisions, and this objective did not change. But within that objective, to make those decisions, users need to be able to do both assessments, and they're sort of equal, if you will, in their importance. And to make those assessments, they need two type of information. So what we're trying to capture in this flow chart is to reflect the board decision on this feature.
Nick?
Thank you.
Thank you. It's really following on from Anne's comment. I think it's a question of prominence still. And looking through this, and I agree, going back and thinking about how past returns have been generated, it does provide information in terms of thinking about future cash flows. But you could, as an alternative, looking at the blocks, in the third block, you could lose that right-hand box completely. And actually, then down in the fourth block, just drop the words in the top half about stewardship. And it still stacks up to my mind. I think there is some confusion in bringing that in that third block, the right-hand element in there, and it is giving more prominence. It is important in terms of assessing returns.
So would you combine the two blocks? Is that what you mean?
No, I would have, so block three, I'd have expectations about return depend on the assessment of the prospects for future net cash flows, and that would all I'd have in that final section. And then in the fourth block, I'd probably drop the words in the top and of stewardship and have those two blocks underneath, need information about resources and need information about how efficiently and effectively management have discharged their responsibilities.
But I think those suggestions sort of do not really agree with text in paragraph 1.3. So what we've done in the flowchart, we exactly mirrored what is in the text of pre-ballot draft, and the text of the pre-ballot draft reflects the board decisions. So already,
I think what you'd be suggesting there, Nick, would be going back to the original text that we had, that we took a decision to increase the prominence of stewardship if we went down that route.
And I need to step back because I obviously wasn't party to those decisions, so I shouldn't create any more confusion in that respect.
This is such an endless story, and I don't think I'm so happy with what we decided. But Françoise.
Well, I agree with what Julia just said, that the flowchart mirrors pretty well the way the paragraphs are already written. And for that reason, I don't see the need for the flowchart, because I think it shows that the text is very clear. And I read the comments, and as those, in fact, were not really happy with the decision of the board and are not ready to accept it, would like, you know, to be different, in fact.
I don't think the flowchart will make them happy.
I don't know, but I think it's not needed, and it doesn't add anything. And I'm very much prefer, in fact, when I read it first, it's so dry when you read it alone that I thought, well, I mean, is the decision not what I had understood? And then I reread the text and I said, well, but the text is clear. So this is more confusing than anything. So let's keep the text as it is.
I agree with Françoise. I don't think we need a flowchart in a conceptual framework. I think it's even worse than an example. and then when I look at it, I think that well, perhaps we, and I look at the text again, I'm not sure if we've got it completely right, but, you know. But for example, you know, but, you know, why is stewardship important? It is, the first meaning of it, or you, the investor wants to look at what have they done with my money. So it's the backward looking, the confirmatory role of the financial statements. They've done a lousy job. I'm pulling my money out of the company. So I think it is very much related, first of all, not so much about the expectations about returns also, but secondarily, it is first about decisions relating to providing resources to the entity, I believe. And then secondly, yes, also, of course, what they have done in the past gives me confidence or no confidence about the future returns. And I'm not sure if we have written it down correctly, but I think this will lead to a whole set of new questions. Again, I don't think we should have flow charts in a conceptual framework. It's just ugly.
I'd just like to underline something Julia said about the text being very dense, and I think this is not just with the addition of the extra words about stewardship, but it's the existing text. And I agree absolutely that if you sit down in a room like we're doing and you read paragraphs 1.2 to 1.4 through to the end, as we are doing in a kind of disciplined way, then it adds nothing. But what we've found throughout the project is people don't actually read it in that way in practice. What they do is they dip into that section, they find the first word they recognise and they kind of latch onto that, and they don't pick up the whole context. And I think what the flowchart would do is would provide a visual reminder of what that sequence of thought is through there, which is very logical as you read it through, but people just find it very difficult to keep it in their mind for some reason.
I just think that it makes extra clear that the text is possibly not completely fantastic. Tom.
I agree completely with Francois's reminder of the P.G. Woodhouse, where they said the aunt found that reiteration helped her get her points across. If it mirrors, simply repeating it will maybe for this one, but there's probably 100 places. We have three people commented. There are 100 places where we could reiterate to be more forceful. And I just think we should do it clearly once and just keep it straightforward. If the flowchart was going to present something radically different or different information, that's fine, but it largely is just reiteration. And we've only got these two people or three people who raised it. And the conceptual framework, we could double in size, reiterate everything. So I really agree with Francoise. I think it, and also Mary's earlier point, this is going to last a long time. It should be written as concisely and clearly as possible.
Doug, thank you. I am not a big fan of this flowchart, however, actually, I read this flowchart and came back to the original literature. I understand better because it's clearly said that the objective of general purpose financial reporting is just one, not two. And the second step, then decision relating provided resources. So it shows the sequence of thought process. And then when it comes to the expectation, there are two ways. And then in order to assess these two ways, there are these two assessments. So in this sense, actually, for me, it was much easier to understand what the literature wanted to illustrate. So therefore, it doesn't add anything new, but I don't agree that this flowchart didn't add any incremental value. I think it added some incremental value. So therefore, I support having a flowchart. Okay, who wants a flowchart?
We have three in favor.
Three flowcharters.
Brilliant effort.
Okay, shall we have a, yeah, so this is the end of our board meeting.